Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Monday, June 5th. Today, we're catching up with Sun Outdoors reporter Jason Blevins about a recent federal court ruling concerning corner crossings, as well as the latest news on the future of the Seven Peaks Music Festival. Before we start, a quick message. Join the Colorado Sun this September for the first Sunfest this fall. Topics will include policy and politics, the environment and outdoors, healthcare, and much more. Grab your tickets today. Visit coloradosun.com/sunfest. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. On this day, in 1922, the U.S. Supreme Court decided Wyoming versus Colorado, which for the moment resolved a decades-old battle over the West's most precious resource, water. Agricultural settlement in dry parts of the West depends on irrigation to supplement scarce rainfall. In territorial days, Colorado adopted the doctrine of prior appropriation to allot water rights on a first-come, first-served basis, a policy copied by Wyoming and other states. By the turn of the 20th century, competition for water often led states to fight one another in court. The High Court ruled that in natural courses, some water must flow from one state to another regardless of law and practice. More than a decade passed before the Supreme Court issued its ruling in the case. The justices affirmed prior appropriation as a valid policy and rejected the notion that rivers crossing state boundaries trumped the right of upstream diversions. However, to ensure fair use of the Laramie River, the court shaped a Byzantine formula to provide equitable distribution of the water. Colorado, Wyoming, and Nebraska all ended up in court over the Laramie and North Platte rivers in later years to sort out controversies that developed as a result. To avoid legal costs and extended court battles, many western states pursued water compacts as a way to divide the resource, most famously the seven-state Colorado River Compact, adopted less than 6 months after that 1922 decision. Before we continue, join Jason Blevins on June 29th as he hosts Hit the Trail, Tips to Stay Safe While Tackling 14ers. The event is free and virtual. Register today at coloradosun.com/14ersafety. That's 14ER safety. Next, our feature story.
Good day and welcome to the Colorado Sun podcast, everyone, and thanks for tuning in. I'm David Krause, one of the team editors here at the Sun, and I am pleased, as always, to be joined on a Monday with Sun Outdoors reporter Jason Blevins. Hey, Jason, what's going on?
Hey, DK, it's good to see you.
Hey, you've had a couple things in the news lately, so instead of trying to get one topic in, I thought we could just catch up on a few things you've been writing about. So let's just jump right in. We had a ruling last week on a case in Wyoming that a lot of people were watching, concerning what is known as corner crossings, kind of an issue trying to get to public land that is blocked off by private landholders. Jason, kind of walk us through what's going on up in Wyoming and how that might have a bigger effect in the western U.S.
Sure. Wyoming federal judge last week ruled that four hunters did not trespass. They did not commit civil trespass when they stepped over a fence that met at the corner of these public and private property lines. It's kind of an obscure case, but it was being watched nationally as all these different groups and public land advocates and private property owners are kind of looking for clarification on this kind of murky corner crossing issue. Should probably tell everyone what corner crossing is. Corner crossing is when a person steps from public land to another parcel of public land, but you're at a checkerboard corner, and technically when you cross that corner, you are violating, even though you don't touch private property, you are violating the private property airspace of private landowners on those checkerboard corners. You know, so imagine, looks like checkerboard, black and white. Say the black is private and the white is public. When you're stepping from white to white, you are crossing the airspace of, you know, those black squares. So the idea there is that, you know, trespassing in that private land, is it a criminal trespass? Is it a civil trespass? But there's groups out there like the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, which has worked with this GPS outfit called OnX, and they've identified 9.5 million acres of federal public land in the West that are corner locked and technically inaccessible if, in fact, corner crossing is illegal. So a lot of people watching this case, you know, and private landowners have sort of had kind of, you know, access to this public land as the only way to get there. You know, this obviously paid for with public taxpayer dollars, sort of a leftover grid work pattern of public land distribution, private land distribution when the West was settled so many years ago, centuries ago. So a really important ruling that was watched by a lot of people and, you know, could have some pretty interesting ramifications in Colorado.
Yeah, so let's bring that home to Colorado then. There are over 670,000 acres in Colorado that are considered locked by this. Last session, a Republican state representative from Littleton put a bill forward. They knocked it down, put together a task force. Jason, kind of walk us through what Representative Brandi Bradley is doing, or kind of what her thoughts are coming off of this ruling in Wyoming last week.
Yeah, so Representative Bradley in February offered this legislation that would allow public land users to kind of freely cross at those corners by sort of eliminating the possibility that landowners could, you know, pursue trespassing charges against these corner crossers. And it also prohibited landowners from fencing the corners of their land where they meet this public property. So sort of providing a thoroughfare. The hunters in Wyoming in 2021 brought this nifty little ladder that crosses fences. So they were able to cross over fencing at that corners and not technically touch the private property fence. They were acquitted of criminal trespass charges, but the owner of that ranch out there in Carbon County, Wyoming, out east of Rawlins, had said that they committed civil trespass and was looking for some $7 million in damages from these hunters. So again, pretty important case. But Representative Bradley's legislation was sort of mirrored some attempts in Wyoming, Montana, Nevada that lawmakers had attempted similar types of laws that had gone nowhere. Again, you keep running up against private property rights, and we all know how important private property rights are out here in the West, and certainly no lawmaker wants to get kind of into that tornado. But her bill eventually created a task force to more kind of closely study the corner crossing conundrum in Colorado, and now spoke with her last week as she, you know, sort of pondered this decision. She said everyone's been calling her with this federal ruling out of Wyoming, and now she's wondering if maybe she could, you know, should she stick with the task force plan, or maybe even just refloat that legislation in the next session and see if maybe it'll get traction this year. Again, you know, there are lots of people, backcountry hunters and anglers, lots of private property rights advocates, you know, lots of people watching that ruling and thinking, you know, hey, when, you know, if it's not criminal trespass and it's not civil trespass, could we be on the corner of, you know, a time to kind of get some clarity on this whole issue? And, you know, like Representative Bradley said, it's, you know, state kind of needs to come up with a position on corner crossing and get some clarity in this issue, so that you know, like you said, there's nearly 700,000 acres of public land paid for by taxpayers that we can't touch because of the corner crossing issue. So seems really obscure, but it's actually kind of a, you know, big deal, especially in for hunters and anglers and folks who are, you know, want to get onto that public land.
Jason, last question on this topic. How does it parallel? You wrote about, I think earlier this year, or late last year, kind of what's going on with river access and the fishing lawsuit, a guy walking into the river and, you know, they own the land under the water, but you can float on the water. Is there a parallel in these kind of situations, or how do they apply, or how do they not apply to each other?
Yeah, there's, you know, this sort of Colorado Supreme Court has decided it's going to wade into this argument over river access. And that, you know, this goes back, you know, decades in Colorado, where they haven't really been able to pursue a lot of criminal trespass issues for people floating through private property. But there has been some attorney general rulings and sort of quasi-judicial type of rulings that say if you touch the bottom of the river as you're floating through private property, you could technically be liable for civil trespass. There's a fisherman and angler in Colorado Springs that is arguing that all Colorado rivers are public property if they were used for commercial activity back in the day when Colorado was in statehood, and that would be applicable on most major waterways in Colorado. And that could really transform river access in Colorado as the Supreme Court, you know, wades into this argument. We could, you know, Montana, for example, says you can walk the banks of most private property next to a river up to the like 100-year flood zone. So, you know, there's differing rules in terms of river access in the West, and Colorado's had this sort of tenuous agreement where every time there's a conflict, you know, it's sort of spot fire. You know, river advocates will go meet with the landowner and see if there couldn't be a deal that's reached, and that's kind of been the policy in Colorado. But there are some similarities. You know, again, this, you know, public access, recreation growing in Colorado, you know, more folks wanting to get out there, and, you know, these sort of eruptions of conflict seem to be becoming a little more common. And, you know, it's sort of an overarching call for some sort of legal clarity, legislative clarity in there, you know, to where lawmakers might have to wade in and help us find some, you know, eliminate the murkiness on some of these access issues.
Find some common ground, as it were, Jason.
Sure. Let's call it that.
Can't resist a good dad joke every now and then. Hey, all right, let's switch gears. You had a story late last week, kind of some breaking news concerning the Seven Peaks concert. Some people might not know about that. Over 10,000 people there last year. It's a mainly country festival. Started in Buena Vista, shifted to Alamosa last year. Now it's not coming back at all, it looks like, because of some issues that Live Nation, the promoter, had. Catch us up on what's going on there, JB.
Sure. So, been kind of watching this. You know, last year I was, you know, talking to folks out there in Sawatch, and they're like, oh man, we were getting the Seven Peaks. So was able to sort of break that news that Seven Peaks was moving from its home over there in Buena Vista and Chaffee County over to Villa Grove in Sawatch County in the San Luis Valley there. They set up last year, drew, like you said, 10,000-12,000 folks, and was kind of waiting this year if they were going to come back. You know, talking to locals out there in Sawatch County, everybody loved it. You know, it was a great, great way to, you know, open up the valley, get a bunch of economic activity out there. Everybody seemed pretty pleased. Talked to the sheriff. He was, you know, said that Live Nation did an incredible job, really delivered on all its promises, as, you know, which was interesting because they kind of got a little cross with Chaffee County in terms of selling tickets before they had secured their final permits, and, you know, maybe some capacity numbers that Live Nation wanted more, and Chaffee County was, you know, still kind of grappling with some you know, COVID pandemic type limitations that they wanted to keep in place, you know, for this concert. So you know, it's a big deal for some of these smaller communities, and, you know, like we're seeing, some small communities are maybe saying they don't want something like that, but Sawatch County for sure was very much interested in having this, and doesn't look like they're coming back, and that kind of bums people out there in the San Luis Valley. Poked around on some podcasts that I don't really listen to very much, but there was one podcast, the Taste of Country podcast, where the founder of the Seven Peaks Festival, performer Dierks Bentley, last month, early May, he told those fellas on that podcast that, you know, he didn't know if that was the best place to have it out there in the San Luis Valley, saying that, you know, they didn't have enough electricity out there. Cell phone service wasn't that good. And he told those folks on that podcast that we didn't make any money. We lost millions of dollars, end quote. He was suggesting that maybe there's a possibility the event could move to Red Rocks, which would be a different event because, you know, it was a 3-day camping festival with, you know, folks sort of gathered in their campers and tents and everything like that. Much different vibe than what you get at Red Rocks, which obviously doesn't allow camping like that. So, but interesting nonetheless, you know, as we kind of shuffle our events after post-pandemic and where these things fit and how that all fits. You know, this will be, if it moves Red Rocks, it'll be a third location for the third iteration of this festival. So it's going to be interesting to see how it all shakes out.
Jason, can they call it Seven Peaks if they move it out of the Arc Valley area?
It's funny because they did it. You know, it was named Seven Peaks because of the Buena Vista Ranch where it was at, property, beautiful property, was, you know, in the Swatch Range with the 714ers right there and the thing. And, you know, that was sort of something I was asking Live Nation when they were getting across with Chaffee County. I'm like, where are you going to move to? Like, where would you be able to do it? And the San Luis Valley has those San Cristo Peaks, San Gregorio Cristo Peaks. So they could technically still call it Seven Peaks. There were seven peaks on the horizon there. So more than seven, but there were seven. So it would still work. So I wonder if Red Rocks, you'd have to call it, I don't know, Two Peaks. What do they call the fins out there? Shiprock and the other one?
Yeah, there you go. Two rocks. That's what we'll call it. We'll give them a heads up. But I think we better trademark that so Dirks doesn't take it from us, right?
Well, we can give it to Dirks. He seems like a nice guy.
Yeah, get a couple of tickets out of the deal.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, JB, always great time catching up with you. We'll do this again next week. Want to thank everybody for joining in and listening. If you want to read more about the Colorado outdoor scene, catch up on these stories, I encourage you to visit coloradosun.com/outdoors, and you can always sign up there for Jason's weekly Outsider newsletter, where both of these stories that we talked about today actually broke the news on those stories in the newsletter. So, Jason, have a great week, buddy.
Thanks, CK.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. The manufacture, possession, and sale of unserialized firearms and firearm parts, known as ghost guns, is now banned in Colorado under a bill signed into law Friday afternoon. Governor Jared Polis called ghost guns a deadly loophole in state gun laws. The Senate bill, which went into effect as soon as it was signed, made it a Class 1 misdemeanor, punishable by up to 364 days in jail to violate the ban. Subsequent offenses are a Class 5 felony, punishable by up to 3 years in prison. Potentially groundbreaking technology and health solutions are being developed right now in Colorado, and they're getting a boost from the state's Economic Development Agency. Now in its 10th year, the state's Advanced Industries Program recently sent $10 million in seed money to 43 companies to develop a concept and figure out a business plan. The program targets seven industries that increase Colorado's economic productivity, such as aerospace, advanced manufacturing, and bioscience. Since launching, the program has funded 714 projects and provided $128 million in grants. By the end of the last fiscal year, grantees had created 4,400 jobs and 124 companies. Life as a Colorado cattle rancher is challenging, but community gatherings for branding days are a way for the families separated by miles of farmland to stay connected. Every spring, thousands of newborn calves across the state are gathered up to be branded and given vaccines. Even with advancements in ranching, many still rely on the old-school way of roping and marking calves one by one. In this week's Colorado Sunday feature, reporter Jennifer Brown and photographer Hugh Carey look at the traditions and fellowship that continue each year. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again next time. Now, a quick message from our editor.
I'm Larry Rickman, editor and co-founder of the Colorado Sun. The Sun is a public benefit corporation, and we rely on the support of listeners and readers like you to produce the nonpartisan, in-depth news that Colorado needs and deserves. Please consider becoming a Sun member for just $5 a month. Learn more at coloradosun.com. Thanks.